comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where U of I theater students present the award-winning play Intimate Apparel, and dance students entertain with wide-ranging movement language in Studio Dance 2. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program today, we're going to take a look at today's Catholic Church and the struggle over its future. Our guest is journalist Robert Blair Kaiser. He is a Catholic who spent 10 years in the Society of Jesus, a contributing editor in Rome for Newsweek. He is the author of A Church in Search of Itself, Benedict XVI and the Battle for the Future. In this book, Kaiser looks at the divisive issues facing the Catholic Church today, including the sex abuse scandal, the shortage of priests, the roles of women and gays in the church, and the growing role of lay people. He also provides portraits of some of the cardinals who met in Rome almost 1 year ago now, in April of 2005, who selected Joseph Ratzinger to succeed John Paul II. Robert Blair Kaiser covered Vatican II in the 1960s as a reporter for Time magazine. He says Vatican II was an effort to move away from papal absolutism and put the church in the hands of its people, its members. Kaiser says the role of the church's pope and its bishops is to serve, and he writes of a people's church, the People of God Church. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. As I mentioned, our guest, Robert Blair Kaiser, spent 10 years with the Jesuits. He left 3 years shy of ordination. Since leaving, he has been a religion reporter for the New York Times, Time, and CBS. He is the editor of the online journal of religion and culture, JustGoodCompany.com. The author of 5 books, his latest, A Church in Search of Itself, is published by Knopf. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Kaiser, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
Sure. You speak of a people's church where the pope and bishops are accountable to the people they serve. And you also note early in the book that that might sound pretty cheeky.
It's not as radical as it sounds, because if you know anything about the church history, you know that in the first 6 centuries in Rome, the people of Rome elected the bishop of Rome, who was, in fact, the pope. And in the 5th century, Leo the Great laid down a principle that he who presides over all must be appointed by all, must be chosen by all, is the exact words. And Leo the Great's words were re-uttered by Gregory the Great. So two great popes laid down that principle. And in the early history of the United States, the U.S. church began on a democratic line, a people's church. How so? Well, John Carroll, the first bishop of Baltimore, was elected by the priests of the new nation, not appointed by the pope in Rome. And he tried to make it very clear to the pope in Rome that Americans would not stand for the bishops to be appointed by Rome. They should be elected by the priests and the people. That, however, didn't fly very well.
Yeah, why did the church move away from that?
Rome is Rome, and the center likes to hold on to its power. And the model was set 1,000 years ago in the 11th century by Gregory the Seventh, and somehow they got stuck. They got stuck in the monarchistic ways, and, of course, the Enlightenment came along, and they resisted that. And the new principles of the new nation, they thought, well, democracy was really kind of suspect. So it's a different attitude, different culture. And I'm maintaining in my book and in my talks around the country right now that we can take back our church. You know, there are a lot of Americans don't quite cotton to this Rome dominance by Rome. We feel Rome doesn't understand. We think canon law is so alien to our culture with its secrecy and its top-down kind of governance in a bottom-up kind of world. We think we can take back our church.
Yeah, but there are some American Catholics who will beg to disagree. They like things the way they are.
Always. There are always people who are fearful of change. That's inevitable. The only solution is a kind of education or public opinion has to weigh in here. We're stimulated to do so because of the sex scandal. Both right-wing and left-wing in the Catholic Church are outraged by the spectacle of priests, not a lot of priests, but enough to create a huge scandal in the Church. Priests who are having their way with little boys and little girls, and worse, being covered up for by their own bishops. So, I think there's an outrage factor building, and it continues to go on. The money alone, the Catholics of this country have shelled out over $1.5 billion to the victims of this abuse, and there's another scandal brewing. It's a financial scandal.
Mm.
When we find out how this absolute rule at the top pervades not only the diocesan offices, but even parishes where pastors can salt away money in their own private bank accounts without anybody looking over their shoulder, that will give rise to further outrage.
So you see these two scandals pulling American Catholics toward greater accountability and a people's church.
Right, and I'm not talking about changes in doctrine. We're not arguing over whether there ought to be three persons in one God or four, or arguing over the divinity of Christ. We're not talking about our faith. We're talking about the way we govern ourselves, which is a changeable thing. The church hasn't always been governed this way and need not always be governed this way.
You write about an autochthonous church. I hope
right.
I got that right.
Autochthonous church. Yes.
Autochthonous church. What does
Celeste,
that?
That's the model that will allow us to assert our identity as American Catholics, still loyal to the Pope, but with our own form of governance. And the model is the autochthonous churches, mainly of the Middle East, the Maronites, the Melkites, the Copts, the Byzantines, the Chaldeans, and so forth. They've been exercising their own polity. They have their own patriarch, their own form of governance, their own clergy, some married, some not married, their own liturgies and their own language. They're enculturated in their own culture. They are what they are, and yet they're still loyal Catholics. They're not Orthodox. They're loyal Catholics, loyal to the Pope. And their patriarchs show up at ceremonies like they had this week in St. Peter's Square when 15 new cardinals were receiving their red hats. So I'm saying, and I'm not saying this on my own, I've had some of the best theologians in the world I've been mentored by in Rome, and they point out to me, they don't want to say it out loud because they would be in trouble if they did. It's stirring things up. But they have shown me how it's quite possible for the American Catholic Church to become a new kind of an autochthonous church. Autochthonous is a difficult word, but it's an easy concept. It means homegrown. It doesn't mean autonomous. It means homegrown. It's to translate in modern cultural terms what Tip O'Neill said many times, all politics is local.
Mm, okay. But now, does this mean that we're heading down a path where the church becomes a democracy? You know, Catholics will say, you know, the church is not a democracy.
It was at one time, and so I don't know why we want to admit our fault here. Democracy is the one best way of proceeding. It was only a few years ago that John Paul II told the bishops in Hong Kong that he was all for their efforts to create a democracy in Hong Kong, and the new Pope, Benedict XVI, said it just 2 days ago. So why should democracy be good for the people of Hong Kong and not be good for the people of the Universal Church, or at least the Church in America? I'm not saying the whole world has to start instituting democratic machinery. I'm not talking about democracy, pure democracy in the Church. I'm talking about our American Church imitating and modeling itself in its governance on the American Constitution, which is not a pure democracy. We live in a representative republic where we have checks and balances. We have no checks and balances in this church of ours.
Yeah.
We have absolute power exercised absolutely, which, as Lord Acton pointed out, leads to absolute corruption.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Robert Blair Kaiser, author of A Church in Search of Itself, Benedict XVI and the Battle for the Future. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Charleston on line 4. Hi.
Yes, I have a question and a comment.
Okay.
If the gentleman can tell me, I've not researched it or I keep up the best I can, but the pedophilia, is it more pronounced in the U.S. than other parts of the Catholic domain?
It's gotten more publicity in the U.S. because we have something called a tort system where victims can go to court and sue for damages, and also because we have a free press, which has really gotten on this story. You may recall that in the winter of 2002, when the story broke big time in Boston, the New York Times had the story on page one for 46 straight days. We're more aware of it here in America, but in many Anglo-Saxon countries, like Ireland, England, South Africa, and so forth, we're getting the same story. Pedophilia is not an American problem, even though one of the cardinals in Rome suggested that it was.
Okay, well then my comment is, since you've referred to it as the tort, or the right to sue, if I were the Pope, I would declare, under the tort system, bring me the proof. If someone, this man who was up in his 40s, was having these flashbacks and this other, I condemn the whole process because the courts will hear these accusations, and I have never heard so far a shred of proof.
Well, if there were no proof, sir, why would the American bishops have paid out $1.5 billion so far? They've been caught red-handed.
Well, my assessment of it is that they want to take the path of least resistance. If we pay, okay, we're not going to argue about this. We are not going to ask for proof. We're not going to fight the courts, because then that'll become counterproductive too, since you can fight back and don't fight back. I mean, it is one of those things that I find most egregious in the church, the Catholic Church today. I mean, I don't agree with a lot that goes on there, and or the historical role of Catholicism overall. But nevertheless, you know, and as you just said, the tort system is what it is. And if you find the right victim, which in this case I think is the church, you can take her to the bank, because there is no... How do you relive this stuff under psychiatric examination, and suddenly, oh, I remember this priest.
Well, you're referring to a few cases where people have had a recovered memory.
Yes, well, I mean,
but if you've talked to any of these people and you know them intimately, you can understand why their memory has been clouded. This is a terrible thing to happen to a young person.
Well, I've never been the victim of a homosexual, but when I were a youth, I mean, I had these approaches and all these things, and I got away. I was never trapped or kidnapped or anything like that.
Well, but thank God.
Yes. Well, I'm grateful for that. But there's the situation under which those things can happen, I suppose, is more doable within the confines of the church.
Well, I'm not looking at those particular events. I'm trying to look at the causes. Why can this happen? I'll give you an example. There was a pedophile priest in Boston, one of the most notorious. His name was John Gagan. He was transferred from one parish to another parish to another parish to another parish and kept going at these kids. And there's lots of proof, and in fact, his own admissions. And he was tried and convicted and sent to prison. If there had been a mom, a single mom, on the personnel board of Cardinal Law's personnel board committee in Boston, if there'd been a single mom on that committee, she wouldn't have tolerated for 1 minute the transfer of John Gagan from St. Stephen's to St. Mark's to St. Bridget's to St. Patrick's. She would have said, enough already. We've got to put this guy away. She wouldn't have stood for it. But there was no mom on those personnel committees anywhere in the country. The canon law says that lay people cannot tell priests what to do. So I'm looking at the institutional cause of this thing. There isn't enough input on the part of the people. We've got Lord bishops exercising their absolute power. We have priests who have that kind of aura of power that allow them to do what they want with little kids, and the little kids don't know what to do. They're caught up in a real contradiction.
And I'm going to move on now. I want to thank the listener for his call. Invite others to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. One more follow-up question on this, though. What do you think of Rome's response to the American sex abuse scandal?
Their first response in Rome was, it isn't happening. This must be a conspiracy on the part of the American press. They were in denial. They finally had to listen to the American bishops who were telling them, oh, no, we're afraid to, sorry, we have to report this, but it is happening. It has been happening, and it's still happening. So they didn't know what to do. The traditional stance of Rome is to cover up any scandal, and that's from an institutional point of view. Their first temptation, their first move is always to cover up for the institution. They've got a big thing here. They've got a 1.1 billion Catholics in the world, and it rests largely on the holiness of its priests. Hierarchy itself, the word from the Greek, means rule by the holy. And so for centuries, they've been ruling because they're holy. Now, all of a sudden, here comes this sex scandal, and we're beginning to get a glimmer of a notion that they're not as holy as they said they were.
How does the Vatican think about the idea of an autochthonous church, a people's church, and accountability of its hierarchy?
That's a good question. In fact, the current Pope, Benedict XVI, wrote when he was a theologian way back in 1969 about the possibility of new patriarchates, is what he called them, i.e. new autochthonous churches, and he was looking mainly at Asia and Africa. But there's no reason why that same principle can't and shouldn't be applied in places like the United States. The reason why he was even considering that was that at Vatican II, at the Council, the Parliament of the World's Bishops that was held in the early 60s, the bishops, mainly from the Africa and Asia and Latin America, talked with some concern about the way the church had grown in their continents. The explorers of the 15th century came to Africa and Asia and founded colonial churches with a colonial architecture, colonial theology, colonial devotions. And so the church in Africa and Asia had a decidedly European cast. And these bishops at Vatican II were saying, Christ shouldn't need a passport in Africa or a passport in Asia. We should have an African-looking church in Africa, Asian-looking church in Asia. And so that was a principle called enculturation. And after the council, Rome looked quite favorably upon the enculturated church, say, in the Congo, where they put together a new kind of liturgy, more apt for Africans, and it worked. They had drums and dancing in the mass, colorful costumes, and the church in the Congo began to look more like the church, like a Congolese church, and yet it was still had the same faith of their fathers. It still was a church that was loyal to Rome, and when the Pope John Paul II came to visit, he was greeted with, you know, millions of people in the Congo would turn out. So there was no question about their devotion to the Pope and to his look to him for his guidance in faith, in our faith matters. But no one seems to have been thinking, very few have seemed to have been thinking, about how to enculturate the church in America. And I say it's not through drums and dancing, but by looking at the American culture and seeing how we are really a democratic people, and we want ownership of and citizenship in our own church, but there's no way that we can have it because canon law, which is, I think, is a sacred cow, says we can't have it. Well, there's no reason why we can't scrap canon law and write our own law.
How often does canon law, church law, change?
Well, they just recently revised it in 1983. Before that, the last revision was in 1917. But it's based on Roman law, and it's decidedly not democratic. There's no oversight. There's no checks. There's no balances. The Pope is all three branches of government. He's the executive branch. He's the legislative branch. He's the judicial branch, and there's no appeal.
Hmm. An enculturated church in America, do you think it would pull in the idea, the American ideal of the public square and the town meeting?
Yes, absolutely.
What else might it look like?
Well, I think that canon law itself, interestingly enough, has already set up the machinery whereby we can change our church. We had what they call a regional synod, national synod. We had three of them in the 1800s, the first, second, and third councils of Baltimore, when the American bishops set up rules for the Catholic Church in America. Example, they made the six holy days of obligation in America that were different from the holy days of obligation in other countries. They instituted something called the no meat on Friday rule, which was not universal around the world. They even went so far as to declare that anyone who got divorced was automatically excommunicated. Not divorced and remarried, just divorced. Well, they have since abrogated that rule. In any event, there was no Council of Baltimore in the 20th century, but I'm saying that we could have a new Fourth Council of Baltimore where we got together to restructure the American church along constitutional lines. We could even institute a tripartite form of government, an executive branch, a judicial branch, and a legislative branch with two houses, a House of Bishops and a House of Commons, where there'd be checks and balances. And when any issue came up, it would be dealt with, according to it, a long intellectual tradition in the church through dialogue and consensus. You know, the House and the Senate have hearings all the time, and they listen to the people. People are allowed to say what they want. This is not something new. It goes all the way back to Jesus talking to the predecessors of our bishops, the apostles, when he said, I'm going to give you a new kind of authority. It's not the authority of the princes and kings of the Gentiles. It's an authority to serve, not to dominate. Let he who thinks he's the most be the least. So he instituted the idea of a servant church, not a lordly church. We've got quite the opposite today, principally because of the structure. these new organizations called Voice of the Faithful and the Call to Action, American Catholics who are calling for a change in structure, haven't gone beyond just calling for a change in structure. They're asking the bishops to be good, to be accountable. Well, bishops won't be accountable unless we change the structure.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Robert Blair Kaiser, author of A Church in Search of Itself. He's a Catholic. He spent 10 years in the Society of Jesus, leaving a couple of years shy of ordination. And he is a contributing editor in Rome for Newsweek. He is also the editor of the online journal of religion and culture, JustGoodCompany.com. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. You can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. We've got some listeners waiting to talk with you, Robert Kaiser. Let's go first to a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I was thinking there are people, many good so-called, quote-unquote, Catholics who feel like anything you say along the lines you're talking is like saying that I think people are afraid that when you talk about democracy, that means democracy when choosing what we're going to believe.
No, I'm not talking about our faith. I'm
talking
about the way we govern ourselves. They're two different things.
Yeah, that's what I feel, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the difference? But a lot of people have trouble with the voice of the faithful for that reason. They just think these people are that the voice of the people, a voice of the faithful is something that's trying to change the faith. I mean, they just look at them as schismatics or heretics or something like that.
Well, that's why I picked up this model called autochthony, because we're not talking about schism. We're talking, it's a much more mild Greek word, meaning homegrown.
Yes.
And it's a human thing. I mean, I'm not talking about the faith. We all believe that pretty much the same things. And in fact, there's more that unites us, right-wing and left-wing, in the Catholic Church than what divides us. And we ought to emphasize that.
Good. I agree. Thank
you. Okay. Thanks for the call.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana. Line two. Hi.
I'm not a Catholic, but my life and lots of other people's lives, particularly women, are affected by the doctrine of the Catholic Church. And I think that the Catholic, and with regard to family planning, I think that the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy has a lot to answer for the human misery and death that have been caused by its opposition to artificial birth control. Not only in the theater of AIDS prevention, in opposing access to people for condoms. So many women contract AIDS from their husbands. But also, their unbelievers are clearly using birth control and limiting the size of their families. But also, if you go to a Catholic hospital to give birth and you need to have your tubes tied, it doesn't matter in many Catholic hospitals whether you might die if you had another kid or not. You can't have your tubes tied. You have to expose yourself to a second procedure outside of that hospital. And you have to also run the risk of possibly getting pregnant in the meantime. The whole idea that, as voiced by the current Pope, my voice is getting quavering here because I feel so strongly
yes,
about
obviously.
It. Saying,
you're among friends. Go ahead.
Saying that other religions were deficient, that we're not. If you're not Catholic, your religion is deficient. I just find to be so insulting, and to not recognize that other people. And Catholic as well might realize that it makes sense to only have children that you can care for adequately and parent adequately. I just find to be abominable, and I think that fits in with the whole sex scandal. It's that should be a forefront scandal. We should be holding the Catholic Church's feet to the fire and saying, hey, you don't have any clothes on with regard to this.
That's correct.
You're causing too much misery in the world. And it's such a contrast because here the Catholic Church stands up and says, and has good reason to say we are concerned about the poor, we're concerned about the human condition, and then to totally ignore this major, major thing that affects the human condition.
When you talk about that church, you're talking about the institutional church, which has a real blind spot and almost everything to do with sex. The good news is that the Catholic people have rejected that so-called teaching on contraception. It's a teaching that has not been received by the people. Therefore, my theologian friends tell me it's not a teaching at all. And I write about this in my book, A Church in Search of Itself. So I think we have to stop looking to the so-called official teaching on these sex matters and look at what the people do. And these are good Catholic people who exercise, who practice birth control in good conscience. 95% of the Catholics in this country, Catholic married couples, do that. So I think we have to stop looking at the official statements out of Rome and look more to our own people.
I want to thank the listener for her call, and I've got a number of other folks waiting to talk with our guest this afternoon. So let's go next to a listener on line 3 in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I want to change directions a little bit. I'm wondering what you think that if such a template was put in place in the American Catholic Church, what it would do for ecumenical relationships.
It can only help because it would bring us all much more together. As Americans, we have very little trouble. American Catholics have very little trouble relating to their Baptist neighbors, their Methodist neighbors, their Episcopalian neighbors, even their Jewish neighbors, now Muslim neighbors. We tend to want to be together and to love one another. To put walls between us is not very American.
Yeah,
an American-looking church would be far more ecumenical. In fact, at the council in the 60s, the Americans were leading the charge toward new attitudes toward the separated brethren.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think that it might even attend to some of the problems that the church has, the Roman Catholic Church has in calling priests, if there was an opportunity for a married priest. In the American context, I think you would have a flood of folks to the ministry.
Personally, I think we would, and I think if we gave a sense of ownership and citizenship in the church, I think the churches would be jammed with young people. Right now, you go to most Catholic churches, you see mostly gray heads. Where are the young people? They've given up. They'd have no sense of ownership in this church.
Where the block is with the kids, it's a distrust of accountability and authority.
Well,
I don't think the issues are with the church itself. Maybe I'm naive, but I think one of the big blocks for young people is a sense of that the authority is demonstrated that there's some accountability problems.
Right. Now, how you get accountability in, say, the city of Urbana, you vote for your mayor. Mm-hmm. And once you vote for your mayor, you kind of watch him, or you get your newspapers and your news media to keep track of the mayor, and if he is a bad mayor, you unelect him or you recall him. That same kind of dynamic could well obtain in the Roman Catholic Church in America. If we elected our pastors, if we chose our pastors more on the congregational model, the pastors would be accountable to the people, not to their bishop. By the same token, if we elected our bishop, the bishop would be accountable to us, not to the Pope in Rome.
Mm-hmm. And some of the more pressing doctrinal issues aside, I think that would speak to a greater sense of universality in the church, too. I think that would just be a slam dunk.
Okay. Well, you said it better than I.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener on a cell phone on line 1. Hi.
Hello. I may be advertising my ignorance in not having read the church against itself here, but I'm just asking this question. In search of itself.
We're looking for our identity.
Yes. I admire this tremendous concept of enculturation in the third world, but working democracy in the United States, I'm wondering what your thinking is and how you would articulate what intrusions might result on the doctrine of papal infallibility if, in fact, everything began to work well as far as a congregational church in the United States?
Infallibility is kind of a sacred cow. It's more of a symbolic idea than a real one. Popes have only exercised infallibility twice in the history of the church. In 1870, when Pius IX declared that Mary was immaculately conceived, so-called Immaculate Conception, and in 1950, when Pius XII declared it was of faith that Mary was assumed into heaven, body, and soul. These two doctrines don't have a whole lot of practical consequences, and those, in fact, are the only times that the Pope has ever spoken infallibly. So we kind of have to look to history on this. Pius IX forced the bishops at Vatican I to declare him infallible, even though it was against Catholic tradition. One of his aides said as much to the Pope, "Holy Father, this is against Catholic tradition." And Pius IX rose up, puffed himself up, and said, "I am tradition. I am the Church." Marvelous expression of absolute absolutism. So we've got to look to history on this. And I don't know any Catholic theologian who believes in infallibility as it was defined at Vatican II, that the Pope is infallible in himself, not out of consensus with the Church.
Ah, that clarifies then.
Okay.
Then tradition itself will be the higher authority.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate this program.
Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign. Line 2, good afternoon.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
A couple of loose-ended comments that probably will not tie together, but I've been glancing through the book, A Church in Search of Itself, and I find an underlying sense of hostility towards the current pope, an underlying sense of hostility towards John Paul. That's one statement, okay? Two, are you familiar, I'm sure you're familiar with Malachi Martin, right?
Yes, I wrote a book called Clerical Error, in which he is the villain of the whole last third of the book.
That's, okay, you're the person that wrote that his personal life was not
right.
Something to be...
Yeah, he ran off with my wife.
He ran off. Okay,
okay.
I read part of that. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't make the connection. Okay, well, that's going to...
Why did you bring him up?
I read his novel, Windswept Lodge.
Windswept House, okay.
Windswept House, you're right. But would you have any comment on that novel, plus his friend William H. Kennedy's book, Lucifer's Lodge? Are you familiar with that book?
No, I'm not familiar with Kennedy's book.
Okay.
But Malachi Martin was a scoundrel and a mythomaniac who made things up. And he this book, Windswept House, that you speak of, he shows the Vatican to be caught up in devil worship. I mean, he was kicked out of the church. He ended his life as working with Catholic schismatics because those were the only people who seemed to buy his bill of goods. I'm almost tongue-tied when I start talking about Malachi Martin.
Sorry. Okay, well, I'll just drop the whole thing, but... Lucifer's Lodge, William Kennedy's one of his schismatic followers. So.
Okay,
But you might want to pick...
Well, I think of myself as a loyal Catholic, and I criticize even John Paul II and even Cardinal Ratzinger when he was Cardinal Ratzinger. I criticize them in the same sense that I can criticize the Bush administration, I criticize the Bush administration not because I hate America, but because I love it and I want to make it better. The same is true in the church. I criticize certain elements in the church not because I hate it, because I love it and I want to make it better.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Robert Blair Kaiser, author of A Church in Search of Itself, Benedict XVI and the Battle for the Future. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have got about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program, and we could probably take a call or two more this afternoon. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. What happened in the 60s with Vatican II? There was a move to open the church, give Catholics a more, you know, a less top-down church and a more ecumenical church. Mm-hmm. Why has the church moved away from Vatican II?
Because the Paul VI was the pope who was around at the end of Vatican II, and he started pulling back toward the end of his papacy. When the cardinals got together to elect his successor, they elected John Paul I, who lasted 33 days. He was more or less going to be a liberal pope, we thought. And then he died, and they brought in, and they came back and voted for his successor, someone who could kind of put the lid on all of the ferment that was going on as a result of Vatican II. When you write a charter for a people's church, you create a certain amount of what looks to Rome like chaos, and Rome is kind of over-controlling. They're like John Paul II became an over-controlling father. He loved his kids, but he loved them too much, and he insisted on a 10 p.m. curfew. That I'm saying that figuratively, and so we were in the throes, in the grip of a rather over-controlling papacy that started pulling back from the people's church. They attempt to re-clericalize the church, so that now we've got the spectacle of, at one point in our liturgies, the sanctuary would be filled with lay people. Now they're saying lay people should stay outside of the sanctuary. Let the priest be up there alone and put him on a pedestal. Some people are even saying, let him turn his back to the people again.
You know, though, it seems to me that the church has got to rely more and more on its lay people.
Well, it is, de facto. We're losing priests. I'm not good on numbers, but 30 years ago, there was one priest per, say, 2,000 Catholics. Now there's like one priest for 100,000 Catholics. So a lot of parishes don't even have a priest. They have parish administrators. Often enough, they're nuns who are doing a great job, but they're not priests. Sure, history itself is forcing us to rethink the whole notion of priesthood. I have a whole chapter, an essay in the middle of my narrative called Priesthood, in which I lay down some of the anomalies in this thing, where we say priests are all important, but we're having fewer and fewer of them.
We've got one last caller waiting to talk with us. Let's get this person in, this listener in Champaign. Line one, hi. Line one, are you there?
Yes, I'm non-Catholic, but I'm fascinated with the Catholic Church. And I wanted to go back, and I don't know if you cover this in your book or this has come up in the discussion, but the latest elevation of Pope Benedict XVI to the papacy, I noticed that three regions of the world, Latin America, Africa, and Asia, are, I guess you could say, really strong in their Roman Catholicism. And I thought, and I have an Asian friend who thought, that this might be an opportunity that for a bishop, for a pope to come from one of those third world continents.
Yes.
And I know a Filipino, for example, who was dismayed upon being informed that a German
mm-hmm.
had been elected as pope,
mm-hmm.
Thinking that there was a chance, for example, that the Philippines, who achieved this very fervently, Roman Catholic, might have a chance, or some other Asian, Latin America, or African prelate could come forward. What is the politics of being elected to the pope, and is it possible someday that we could get a pope outside of Europe?
Theoretically, yes, but this last conclave had 115 cardinals who were very conservative. They'd all been appointed. All but two were appointed by John Paul II. And it was like the board members of the Coca-Cola Corporation getting together to elect a new CEO to replace their old CEO who had just died. And they wanted continuity. They didn't really want change. So they tended to elect a carbon copy of the last pope, because, you know, Cardinal Ratzinger and the pope were very, very close. And they were like one body and one brain, the two of them. Theoretically, of course, the College of Cardinals could elect any baptized male, but politically speaking, they only elect one of their own, and they've been doing that since 1378. I think we pay too much attention to the Pope, frankly. I think part of the reason for that is the media. The media has created a Pope as a celebrity. He's an iconic figure like Madonna or Elvis. And we look to the Pope as, well, he's the church. Well, the Pope is not the church. We are the church. And the church in all of its enculturations all around the world is a marvelous thing. If you just look at it in its variety, we're all united by the same faith. We serve the same Lord through His mainly through our devotion to the poor and the downtrodden and the homeless. That Christian witness is being carried out all around the world and by people who never think about the Pope. They're Catholics. They're Christians.